I call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 27th, 2020, and the time is 2:08. Present today is Representative Knopp, Representative Lebon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and Representative Wall, and myself, Co-Chair Johnston. As we start, please remember to mute your cell phones. This afternoon, our agenda is to have reintroductions of three bills that the committee heard and held last session. First up, we'll be having House Bill 79 by Representative Kopp, Peace Officers and Firefighters Retirement Benefits. Second, we'll hear from House Bill 30 by Representative Josephson, Workman's Compensation, Death, Permanent Partial Impairment. Finally, we'll hear House Bill 102 by Representative Wohl, Rental Vehicles by Private Owner. My intention is to hear all three of these bills and then set them aside. House Bill 71 was last heard in House Finance on May 15, 2019. Over the interim, the sponsor of the bill has worked on committee substitute, and that is before us today for consideration. Representative Foster.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that the House Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 79 Finance, Work Order Number 31-LS0462-O, as our working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. I'd like to invite to the table Representative Kopp and his staff, Ken Truitt, to walk us through the committee changes. Please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, House Representative for District 24. I have with me my team member, Mr. Ken Truitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ken Truitt, for the record, staff for Representative Kopp.
Thank you, committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to give an overview of the bill. Just a refresh, it's been close to a year since we've last heard this. So House Bill 79 has some features that differ from previous PERS pensions that make the new tier financially sustainable. It proposes a new retirement plan for peace officers and firefighters, and it's a hybrid between a defined benefit pension and what we have in Tier 4 with the medical benefit, which is essentially a house or a medical savings account. So the plan has many features or levers that have been designed to keep the plan solvent, and they fall into three categories. The first category is cost-saving features. The second is plan asset enhancement adjustments. And the third feature is plan benefit reductions. So under the cost-saving features, there is no retirement medical insurance. There's no retirement medical insurance. So the medical benefit is the same as Tier 4, which is a health reimbursement arrangement. And it is to be a bridge to Medicare. The fixed age of retirement is 55 years with 20 years of service instead of any age at 20 years of service. So if you retire from public safety if you begin at 24, let's say out of college, and you work for 20 years till 44, you would need to get another job for 11 years before you could take any benefit from your retirement. Retirement income calculation average is on the consecutive high five years instead of the high 3 years in previous PERS tiers. And there is no cost of living adjustment in this proposal. The plan asset enhancements adjustments are as follows. The employee contribution rates can be increased as the actuary is shown that it needs to be increased to keep the projections for solvability of the plan. Solvency, thank you, Ken. The employer contribution to employee retirement benefit is 22%, the same as other tiers, with 12% mandatory to the employee benefit, and the remaining 10% to the current plan unfunded liability. And finally, Madam Chair, the plan benefit reductions deal with the post-retirement benefit adjustment. This can be withheld if the funding is less than 90%. So if the actuary says the plan has dipped below 90% funding, there is no post-retirement pension adjustment. So the cost-saving features, the plan asset enhancement, and the plan benefit reductions all keep this within a range of being a financially sustainable plan. Mr. Truitt, if it be the will of the chair, can talk us through the committee substitute.
Right, and thank you, Representative Kopp. You went a little bit out of order. The committee substitute changes were supposed to go first, but you were on a roll, so I didn't want to stop you.
All right, well, the overview is done then.
Glad that was your mistake, not mine. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ken Truitt, for the record. The good news is there are, with this version O, this committee substitute, there are no substantive changes to the bill at all. During the interim, while we were working with the administration, the Division of Retirement and Benefits, what we came up with in this version are some changes that are just clarifying language. So all of the features that Representative Kopp just described were the intent of the original bill as it was introduced. And the changes that we'll run through real briefly are just language changes that make it more clear that we'll actually accomplish the changes or the features of the bill that Representative Kopp just described. So we'll just hit the changes straight away. The very first change is on page 3, and lines 6 through 9 there, and we'll do a call out on this right here. And committee aide asked me to make sure to explain. Don't get freaked out by the numbers on the left. Section 1 of the bill covers 3 different pages, so just to give you a view of the context of how these changes work, we just took some digital snips from the different pages to show you how the bill, these changes operate in the context of the bill. So you can see that this is dealing with the ARM board's duties, and these changes were not in the original bill. The ones there in the middle of the slide there, lines 6 through 9, paragraphs C and D. And so as you can see, it's just ensuring that the language of the bill, when under paragraph 8, which is when the ARM board does their annual evaluation of the plan, that they're tracking specifically the features of this bill. It's giving them the specific instruction to do that. I think we thought the bill as it was introduced implied that, but again, the administration preferred that it be very, very clear and expressly stated in the statute. And what's below there in Section 2 is not a new change, but it just kind of shows you how this new provision works with the existing new provision in Section 2. Section 2 is the second subsection of the statute there, 3710-220, which also shows you the ARM board's duties and functions. And maybe straight away here, it'd be good to clarify some vocabulary as we talk about this bill and the PERS system in general. If you spend any time with the administration, they're very clear that they're walking back from referring to the different plans as tiers. Using the word tier is a very convenient vocabulary word to kind of keep them straight in your mind. In the bill, you'll never see the word tier 5. This plan, if you will, this tier of the PERS system, it's one system with different features in it. The way that we're describing this, you can see there on the bottom in Section 2 on lines 24, 25, a peace officer or firefighter who first becomes a member after June 30th, 2006. So it's just a little bit easier to say tier 5 than recite all that, but if you read through the bill and you don't see a Tier 5 in, everywhere that you see a reference to June 30, 2006 and people beginning to participate after that date, that's how we carve this tier out of the PERS plan, the system. So the next changes that we have are page 10, section 15. And this differs from the prior version only in the way that it proposes to achieve the goal of ensuring that the new tier of this bill also contributes to the past service liability of the PERS system. You can see it amends AS 39 35 255A by referring to a new subsection, and that new subsection is also new to this committee substitute. And what it does is it just makes sure that the employer contribution rate is still pegged at 22%. And the exception that we'll go over in the next section there, section 18, accomplishes the goal of keeping the 22% employer contribution. So if we look at section 18, subparagraph I, numbers 1 and 2, that's just some fancy way of saying, in number 1, 12% is the minimum that goes to the employee benefit. And then what's in number 2 is just some the fancy way, an amount that is equal to the difference between the per capita amount determined in number 1 and A of the section, is to say that everything else is going towards the unfunded liability of the existing PERS plan. So it's, and the 12% mandatory to this tier's employee benefit is higher than what you have in tiers 4 currently. So this is one of the features to make sure that the contributions going to help sustain the plan are enough to fund the benefit that's been guaranteed by the bill. So that is something that's a little bit different, the mandatory 12% going to the employee benefit. And as, like we said earlier, this isn't a new concept to the bill, but the language is new to make it more clear that that's in fact what is happening. And finally, this is on page 13, section 25. We've got the change highlighted in yellow there for you. Lines 4 and 5 are not any different than what was in the prior version. What is different is literally this language that we've highlighted. When we were meeting with the administration in the interim, they tagged this section and said, and this is the section that is the reduction of the benefit for the post pension. So if the plan starts going underwater, this is one of the features where the benefit can be reduced to the employee in their retirement. And the comment that we got from the administration I thought was very helpful. Before, we just referred to the plan there on line 6 at the very end of the line, and this is where, understanding that the PERS system is one plan, their comment was, until the unfunded liability goes away, the plan as a whole will always be under 10%. So these people will never get this benefit. It will always be reduced unless you find a way of saying what we have said here. Now it just says that if the plan that's attributable to all the participants of this tier goes below 90%, then you can invoke, the ARM board could invoke this adjustment and reduce the benefit. So again, this isn't a new concept. It is just making clear that this particular lever or adjusting mechanism can actually be executed as we intended it to with in prior versions of the bill. And those are the changes, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Do you maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection.
Are there any other objections?
I object.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
I would. I'd like some clarification. Madam Chairwoman. So the word attributable here, if the board determines that the portion of the unfunded liability of the plan that is attributable to peace officers and firefighters, what if it's not attributable to peace officers and firefighters? What is that? What's the distinction between the unattributable or not attributable and attributable? What's the, if they decide it's not attributable, then what happens?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that's a very good question. Let me see if I can do it justice. Essentially, then, if we didn't put this language in, this benefit, the post-retirement pension adjustment, they would never receive that benefit. It would always be reduced. And so this is saying that we're going to track the performance of this tier within the system, and if it's performing well, then retirees when they retire, or employees when they retire, will get the benefit of this benefit, or they will receive this benefit. Now, if the plan is still unfunded by at a minimum 10%, but it's not attributable to this group, they will still be able to receive this benefit in their retirement. This is just saying, if we can establish that this plan is performing and is solvent and is funded at least 90%, then the retirees who take under this plan, this part of the plan, will receive this benefit.
Follow up?
Please, the follow up. So there's a lot of if words being used there, and every time you say if, I think in my mind, is it a worst case scenario or a best case scenario that we're planning on with the word if, right? I can't judge that right now. So it sounds to me like you're explaining that there is risk that we institute this and it isn't solvent at some point in time in the future. And if it isn't, then the benefits don't go out. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative yes. Carpenter, yes. Yes, that was a much more succinct way of what I just said, yes. And for clarification, if would be all of these adjustment features, we don't know what the future is going to be. We don't know how the plan's going to perform. We think the plan's going to be solvent, but all of these features are in the bill to plan for contingencies, the ifs that might, the plan might occur in the future.
Follow up.
So, right. I'm not sure how that would reassure me if I was a peace officer or a firefighter, and maybe you can speak to this. I'm being presented with an option that I could choose to participate in a retirement plan that the state is going to underwrite, and I may or may not receive benefits in the future.
So that is a bit of, through the chair, that's a bit of an oversimplification. But you're hitting on something, is that there is a lack of certainty in a future benefit because the levers in this plan keep it reactive to real market conditions. And the language that's been offered here recognizes that within the entire PERS plan, we have now want to track the assets and liabilities of a group of employees separately who are assuming much more risk. And this committee heard testimony last year from the state of Washington's actuary that runs a similar model, and the state of Colorado, that they're at 103% funded, 110% funded under this model. And those are reasons why we want to track this separately, is this model has been proven in other states to perform much more reliably. But in order to recognize that if the plan gets less than 90% funded, we have to have language saying that we're talking about these employees within the larger PERS system. We're tracking the assets liabilities to this employee class. The post-pension retirement adjustment goes away if it falls less than 90% projected funded, which a 90% funded is a gold standard for plans. Does that help, Representative?
Yes, it helps. I understand. I just don't see how that would bring me consolation if I was a peace officer or firefighter looking at this. That's all I have at this moment.
Representative Ortiz.
Question, Madam Chair. Is this the time where we do a deep dive into the bill itself, or are you saving that for a different
My intention meeting? Is just introduction, and we'll set it aside
so
for further discussion.
Hold my questions about the broader impact of the bill till that time. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And keeping in mind what you've just said, I want to stay just on these issues. When you talk about, in your answer to Representative Carpenter about the suspension of the benefit, you're only talking about the suspension of the PPRA, not the bulk of the benefit.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, correct. The post-pension retirement adjustment. You're correct, sir.
Follow up?
So in that respect, the Tier 5 person would have sort of 90% or whatever it is confidence in what they're retiring on.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you are correct. There is still a high degree of confidence in the overall plan, but this is one lever that reduces the benefit if the market isn't performing in a way that the actuary can predict a 90% funded level of confidence. Just one more additional comment, and this gets back to what Representative Carpenter was saying, is what surety does this give peace officers and firefighters? Right now, if you remember, the state's chief investment officer, Mr. Mitchell, told this committee last year that the projected plans under Tier 4 modeled for a high, median, and low-level return over 10 years showed that within 10 years at a conservative spend, they're out of money, and that they're only doing slightly better than Social Security alone. And most municipalities in Alaska have opted out of Social Security. So this plan, while it's very conservative, still is much more of a confidence, a reliability for financial planning to the peace officers and firefighters, albeit it is very conservative.
And follow up?
And is this on the CS?
Yes. But yes. Through the chair, Representative Kopp, you said there would be no COLA, and I'm trying to recall what the difference is between a COLA and the PPRA.
Yeah. Madam Chair, may I ask Tom Westcott to come up to help us out?
Yes,
here.
Yes, Mr. Westcott, would you like to come up to the table, introduce yourself, and who you represent?
Madam Chair, Tom Westcott, President of Alaska Professional Firefighters. Through the chair, for your question, Representative Josephson, the COLA is a benefit awarded under the legacy DB plans for those that remain in the state of Alaska. It's typically an inflation-proofing adjustment in other states, but here it's awarded for remaining in the state, and we eliminated that benefit from our bill as we scaled it back.
If I might, so it sounds like I had this conversation with my mother who moved to New Hampshire and lost 10% of her PERS or TERS, but essentially, this wouldn't be a disincentive to stay in employment and protect Alaska's people. It might, it basically doesn't give the slightly extra incentive to stay here when you're 70 and 75 and 80 years old.
Through the chair. Yes, the COLA benefit has been stripped out, and basically that should be the expensive nature of the state of Alaska should be represented in your pay throughout your career.
Thank you.
So.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes, Madam Chair, I wanted to talk about the actuarial, but I don't know if that's in this piece. Or you want me to read?
I would suggest that's not in the CS. We need to finish adopting the CS. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I'll ask one question, and only because Representative Kopp made mention to it. and that was the five-year average to build your retirement benefit. Does the annual income during those 5 years include overtime paid?
Through the chair, yes, it does.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter, do you still maintain your objection to the CS? No? Okay. So, with the CS in front of us, Representative Kopp, would you like to provide a very brief discussion or introduction of your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for not following the order there. Yes, Madam Chair, we are addressing in House Bill 79 a well-documented inability of the state to recruit and retain public safety employees that are turning over within 5 years, and departments are only retaining high age, not that Mr. Westcott is too old, but very, very experienced employees who are in earlier tiers with a defined benefit. And we have very young employees in the middle class of managers, sergeants, lieutenants, or battalion chiefs, I should say, depending on which side of the public safety fence you're on. We're not able to fill those positions with experienced personnel because they're leaving Alaska for agencies that have a defined benefit. We heard many troopers, you heard them call in, that left the state. You heard firefighters call in. Some of them left Anchorage Fire Department. You heard them call in from Oregon, Washington, Idaho, that were all looking for anything that would give their family some surety after X number of years of service that there would be a benefit that more than Social Security waiting for them. So the cost-saving features of this plan, the plan asset enhancement adjustments, and the plan benefit reductions do result in a very conservative plan that is a true hybrid that addressed the question of a plan that was more than we could afford, and also the question of how do we keep our public safety professionals in Alaska and meet this unmet need. The cost-saving features, there being no retirement medical insurance as part of the benefit, is very significant. It's up to the individual to take their health savings account and to take that pool of money to buy the best health care plan they can until they get to Medicare, and then Medicare will take care of them. The fixed age of retirement at 55, that frankly is not wildly popular among the public safety community. That's working a long time. I retired at 44, and I felt like a long time to be wrestling bad guys when I was well past the age of where I should have been wrestling with 21-year-olds who were powerful young men and drugged up. This requires you to wait to 55 to take your retirement. So for a lot of public safety people, they will be working another job to bridge the time before they can draw that. But it's necessary for the plan to be competitive. The retirement income calculation, we just touched on, average of high five years rather than your high three. No cost of living adjustment, as Mr. Westcott just explained. The employee contribution rates can be increased. And the post-benefit retirement adjustment can be withheld if the plan is found below 90%. Now you might say, well, do you have any support for the bill at all? And the point is yes, we do. And the reason why we do is because what we have is so tough. And that's why this is still considered to be very attractive over what we have today, and why I would just urge the consideration of the committee for this. The public safety community is really united that we need to make this change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions of the sponsor or any of these folks up here about the bill in entirety? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Kopp, I'm looking for analysis then with the actuarial, in the sense of just reviewing the fiscal note. It said that you would be looking at that, and this was from last April. So has there been a chance to have that analyzed, or is that something that we will see after this? After this bill is passed? I guess I'd like to see it before it moves.
So through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, so would we. So we've been working with the administration for a year to get some actuarial analysis. They are working cooperatively with us at this time to get that to us, and we expect it any time.
have any further, Mr. Westcott, on that? No, that's it. It should be very shortly forthcoming.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Kopp or Mr. Westcott, the feature of having to be 55 before you can begin to draw benefits, is that a common age for, you refer to Washington State or California or others that you've studied that you kind of mirrored this, is that this the way it is in those states as well?
So the plans that are similar to this started also around this at 55, and a couple of them have now lowered it to 51 because the intent is not to be 110% funded, but out of an abundance of conservative caution, the states on this model are starting to lower. But most states that have a defined benefit generally are 20, 25 years of service and eligibility, but those are not considered gold standard plans. They're considered, you know, high cost, high liability plans. This plan here is much more conservative than that because of the delay for retirement when you can actually draw the benefit, and but that's why they're affordable.
Follow up.
And is it the analysis, or is, I guess the I don't know if we can do an analysis at this point, but Mr. Westcott, if we were to move to adopt such a plan for public safety workers, would that accomplish, help to accomplish, significantly help to accomplish the goal of being able to retain people within our current system? Or would it not really be that much of an incentive based on, I realize it would increase the percentage from what we have right now, but would it do the job? Because if it does the job, that would mean added savings in a different level, in another area, recruitment, those kinds of things, if it does the job. So,
through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we absolutely think it will help in that manner. One of the characteristics of a defined benefit plan is that the employee invests time, so they have the sunk cost of time, as we'd like to say in economics. You know, they talk about sunk costs. So if you have 7 years of time invested in a department in Juneau, Ketchikan, Wasilla, you might think twice about starting over in Washington State or somewhere like that, and rather make the decision just to continue your career here in Alaska. We did some rough estimates, and if you save 1% of the public safety workforce and use a $120,000 cost on their training, that's $4 million a year. So you don't have to completely solve the problem to pay for this this new plan.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made mention, Representative Kopp, or Mr. Truitt, on the medical gap between 55 and 65. Can you briefly go over what, I know there's no medical coverage in this, what would the retiree do in that? Is there a plan they can buy into that's affiliated with this, or are they kind of on their own?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's a good question. So the health reimbursement arrangement is basically a cash pool of money that builds up through contributions over time. That money is available to be spent on any employee health plan that the employee would like to pick up to bridge them to Medicare. Obviously, different employees will have different needs, but that money is purely market-based decision on the employee's part. Now, some agencies do have affiliations with certain plans. Some do not. It's kind of, it's different from department to department and even state to state. But do you have anything further, Mr. Westcott, on that?
Yes, through the chair. It certainly is a gap, and it's a tough thing for anyone out there trying to purchase health care from, you know, say that age 55 to 65. But it's a problem. We have to attack at a different time in a different manner, because it adds so much cost and uncertainty. When you attach the medical benefit to a pension plan, it's an unknown cost that has grown historically at such a quick rate, it's hard to keep up with. And that's, when we examine plans around the country, that was one of the ways they got into trouble, was providing medical, because it just grew so fast that when people in the 70s and 80s, no one thought it would do that. And then it did.
Thank you.
Representative Lebon. Oh, follow up. Sorry. Oh, Representative
Wall. That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question. Let's say you pay into the plan for X number of years. You plan on retiring. Something happens. You have to leave state. What happens to the contributions that you've made? Do they stay behind? It's not like a 401k that you can take with you. So,
Through the chair, Representative Wall. So once you've met your minimum period where you're vested in the plan, when you're eligible to draw that, you can withdraw the benefit that you have accrued.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of my conservative CPA friends in Fairbanks have suggested to me that one of the things that went wrong with tiers and PERS systems, tier 1, 2, and 3 for TERS and PERS, is that the last 3 years, employees were accepting more remote positions where there was differential pay and or packing overtime into those last 3 years to build the benefit up. Do you have an opinion about whether that contributed to the liability that we face today under those retirement systems?
So through the chair, Representative Lebon, it's that question is a fair question. It's been brought up. So most of our public safety employees are municipality-based and work entire careers in a municipality, so they don't get a geographic differential like you're talking about. Now, certainly our troopers do. But even then, within the trooper pool, there is not a large percent that choose to go live remotely for a period of time. But for obvious family reasons, road system life is preferable. So the issue, I would say, from a CPA's perspective that's driving the cost is not so much where you get your high three, even though this bill stretches that out to 5, so you gotta have a bigger commitment if you do wanna live. But the fact that the state did not make, and we had some bad actuary advice, as you all will recall, and the state actually litigated. We had an actuarial firm that was causing us to underpay in many years the payment, rather than 22%. Now they actually required us to pay nothing. They said, you guys are overfunded. When I was city manager in Kenai, we actually got direction to not pay, you know, which now we think that's absolutely crazy advice, but we got bad actuarial advice. It got our plan in trouble. And now it's all we can do to keep a promise to municipalities at 22% and come forward with plans that are conservative. So a little bit of backdrop to that.
Follow-up?
Follow-up on that would be area differential. If a trooper, if we talk about the trooper class, does take a remote location and receive an area differential, probably in retirement, just guessing, they're not going to live in that remote area. Just assume that that's the case. So why would the retirement benefit be built upon that area differential? And would a change in that philosophy, eliminating the overtime piece and area differential piece and the retirement benefit, help protect the plan and safeguard the benefit?
Madam Chair, I'll have Tom Westcott help me with that one.
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, the practice you're talking about, overtime spiking and those things, are absolutely a concern for pension plans. 5 years was cited as a best practice by Washington State that uses it. It's more representative of a career. So if you're working some overtime and contributing on it, you're not going to have that same problem that you're talking about as somebody in an old plan that could work 1 or 2 years at a significantly higher salary, but the rest of their career not contribute on a salary of that level. So we looked around, and 5 years was cited as a best practice to avoid exactly what you're talking about. And I believe with the troopers that they're required to work 50% of their career in that location in order for that benefit to be accrued for the remote location.
Follow up?
And I'm glad you've looked at that, because we all know folks that work for the university or worked in education or whatever it might be that looked to those last 3 years and took off to work in a remote location or took advantage of that feature in the plan. They worked 17 years in Fairbanks and then 3 years in Kotzebue, and that was for that purpose. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you. We'll set House Bill 79, sorry. House Bill 79 aside.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Oh, Representative Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I will be more loud. I just wanted to follow up on that last line of questioning. The fact that we've got a term for the action called spiking raises a huge red flag to me. The fact that we would recognize that the practice would go on, and we've looked elsewhere to see where they would combat that activity, and we come up with a 5-year average as the way to combat it. Wouldn't it just solve the problem if you put language in the bill that said those spiking activities won't be covered under the retirement plan? Why would you need to go look back 5 years and put an average to basically blend any of the spiking that goes on? Why wouldn't language that prevents the spiking in the first place be a better solution?
So through the chair, Representative Carpenter, a couple things. One is that when you earn more, you contribute more to the plan. And secondly, over time, the reason why this was more effective with 3 years is because that's kind of the maximum amount of time people can do that without complete burnout. It's actually, in public safety, it's more of an aversion to forced overtime. There is so much forced overtime going on in departments where they have to be called out because there is a shortage of officers. If you've been paying attention to the news, my old department, Kenai Police Department, they're down 5 officers in a 21 officer department. Cannot hire anybody. Everybody is working incredible forced overtime, burning out, quitting, walking away from the job. It's very discouraging. So it's not in the context of how you're pointing it. Now, has that happened where people knowingly worked their career toward the very end? They said, okay, I'm going to work a whole bunch of hours and I have the seniority so I can pull this off. Yeah, it has. But that is not the problem facing Alaska departments today. The problem is forced overtime, a lack of ability to fill positions, and basically burnout. By spreading it out over 5 years, you are kind of making sure that if someone does have that, they're going to crash and burn trying to spike for 5 years. It's just physically, you can't do it. But you raise a good point. I don't know that we could legislate that out, though. I'm just trying to think of how you would nuance the bill to say, you know, no spiking because contributions are tied to income. But maybe one of my cohorts. Yeah. I think that's my answer, Madam Chair.
Okay, with that, we will set House Bill 79 aside. Thank you. Next, we have House Bill 30. House Bill 30 was last heard in House Finance April 24, 2019. Over the interim, the sponsor of the bill has worked with my office on a committee substitute, and that is before us for our consideration today. Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Foster.
And I will move that the House Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 30 Finance, work order number 31-LS0280/R as our working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. I'd like to invite my staff, Aaron Shine, and Representative Josephson's staff, Elise Sorum-Burke, to the table to walk the committee through the changes. Please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Aaron Shine, and I'm staff to Representative Johnston.
Good afternoon. My name is Elise Sorum-Burke, and I am staff to Representative Josephson.
So earlier in the session, I worked with Representative Josephson's staff, Ms. Elise, to work on the draft that's before you. The changes between version S from Labor and Commerce version to version R, which is the finance version before you, are as follows. On page one, the title, lines 1 through 5, has been updated to reflect the changes in the language below. On page one, line 7, section 1 is a new section. The previous section 1 has been removed. That was the short title of the bill. Now section 1 is all new language, and this is requiring the division to provide it requires notification of workers at the time of hire of to let them know what their availability is if they are childless or don't have dependents or unmarried. Going to page 2, section 2, this is unchanged language. Section 3 has 2 conforming edits, nothing that's substantial. It's more conforming to the changes in the other sections of the bill. On page 3, section 4, the previous section was removed, which was AS 2330-215A. And then section 4 is a new subsection, which is subsection J, that makes a few conforming changes, mostly on line 9. The language was added, continues until the child reaches 23 years of age unless extended, and was removed. The language that was removed was shall terminate 5 years after the person is no longer considered a child. The final change is in section 5, and that was the effective date change from January 1st, 2020 to January 1st, 2021.
I will remove my objection. Is there any other objections to the CS being accepted? With that, with the CS before us, Representative Josephson or Ms. Sorum-Burke, can you please provide a brief description or introduction of your bill? And I would like to note that we have online Gray Mitchell from the Director of Division of Workmen's Compensation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Elise Sorum-Burke, for the record, staff to Representative Josephson. Ms. Shine went through some of the major changes in this bill, and I think on the whole, this bill did a few things and now does a few different things. Previous to the changes, the main things this bill did was update permanent partial impairment rates in Alaska. This bill before us today still does that. That language has not changed. That's really the core of this bill. Alaska's permanent partial impairment rates have not been adjusted since 2000. We are one of the lowest paying permanent partial impairment rates in the country. What this bill does is raise that rate. If you look on page 2, line 15, from the current rate of $177,000 for whole body impairment to $255,506, which brings us about up, would, if this bill was to be passed, bring us about up to national average. The other thing that this bill does has to do with notice regarding death benefits. Ms. Shine noted that section 1 is a new section. Our original bill added a death benefit for single childless workers that was discussed at length in the Finance Committee last year. There were some philosophical issues brought up by members of the committee, and so we chose to withdraw that part of the bill. But Representative Josephson still thought it was very important that employees be aware of the disparity between what a single childless worker might receive in death benefits and what someone who is married with dependents might receive. So that first section basically just says that employees will be given notice of what would potentially be available to them. It also, there's a different notice of death benefits, and that is in section 3. And that basically says that in the case of death, someone who is a personal representative of an employee will be informed of what benefits might be available to them. Finally, the portion in section 4 has to do with children who are orphans, basically, so who have no parents. And so there was an issue last year with the definition of child. So what this says now is that benefits can continue until the age of 23, so it changes that 5-year number to the age of 23 to basically say that if you are a child who has no parents left, you can continue to receive death benefits from your parents until you're 23. And then that is the cutoff. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the sponsor? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So under Section 4 of this section, continues until a child reaches 23 years of age, was there an age limit in the prior legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp. So the definition of child in that statute that's referenced is a little bit odd because it says that you are a child if you're attending school full time. So it doesn't give a specific age. Instead, it says if you are in college, basically, you are considered a child. So this would, that created a lot of gray area that we weren't really comfortable with in the original bill.
Follow up?
So now it's just age 23 years of age, no matter what you're doing in your life, huh? I mean, so, okay.
Through the chair, yes. And the reasoning for that really had to do with economic insecurity of people who might still be dependent on their families. Not everyone chooses to go to the university. And also, so you could have someone who was, say, serving their country in the military whose parents died, and they would get no benefit under current law. So this would make it more even across the board.
Follow up?
One more time. Thank you. So it says unless extended under AS 23.30. Do you happen to know off the top of your head without me going to the book what that allowable extension is?
Through the chair, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but those are individuals with disabilities, so people who are considered dependents for other reasons, so intellectual or physical disabilities.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would like some clarification on Section 1. If and just allow me to paraphrase for just a second. I think what you said is the law is going to tell the employer that they need to tell the new employee what their benefits would be if they were single or what their benefits would be if they were married with dependents. Do I have that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, for the most part. So the goal is to tell them about their benefits in general at their time of employment. But then it does specify to tell, and this is to tell all, so there's an equal protection issue that we came across when we were drafting this language. And so why it's drafted this specific way is All employees, regardless of their marital status, do have to be told. You can't say, I'm only going to tell this to people who do not have dependents. So basically, it's informing all employees that if you happen to be single and childless, here's what would be different about your benefits. I don't know if that made sense, but.
Madam Chair.
Follow up?
Because I'm trying to understand the why behind it.
Representative Josephson?
If I could, thank you, through the chair, Representative Carpenter. Under current law, if a 19-year-old young man, a tradesman working at Prudhoe or somewhere else, dies, hasn't met his spouse, doesn't have children, and he dies at work, and there's no third-party liability, it's pretty much just a dangerous workplace, say. Or he even, you know, was reckless, but he died. The law doesn't do anything for him. And so you can imagine his family's grieving this. Maybe there was gross negligence on the part of the employer, that the workplace was really dangerous. The family is distraught about it. There's nothing they can do. They can't sue the employer. They can't collect workers' comp. There's nothing they can do but mourn. So what this does is say to that young man when he's hired, if he's reading it, he'll say, you know, I better get some life insurance, because the people that care about me back at home, you know, I may have debts. I may have debts to a creditor. I don't want my estate saddled with those, not that I'm sure that it could be. But essentially, it's a notice to him or her, you're on your own. That's the intent of it.
Follow up?
Not necessary. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, with that, we'll be setting House Bill 30 aside. And we'll be taking up House Bill 102. House Bill 102 was last heard in House Finance on May 3rd, 2019. I'd like to invite to the table Representative Wool and his staff, Ashley Carrick, to provide a brief introduction of your bill. And please put yourself on the record. And we do not have a CS for this, just for everybody's edification.
For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Representative Wool.
For the record, Representative Wool, District 5 in Fairbanks, and I want to thank the co-chair Johnson for bringing this bill forward in front of the Finance Committee today. It was here last session, so I'm prepared to give a short statement to remind members of what the bill encompasses and the issues at hand. So I have a brief statement I can read, and Ms. Carrick and I can help explain the bill or answer any questions. The ways that Alaskans procure transportation services have changed over time. While it used to be common practice to get off a commercial flight and head to the nearest rental car agency, consumers now are turning increasingly towards rideshare, carpooling, and private vehicle rental network options to get to their destination. Much like Airbnb revolutionized the hospitality industry, companies that allow individuals to rent their personally owned vehicles are sweeping the nation as alternatives to traditional rental car options. HB 102 adds a definition for the new service of providing private vehicle rental programs, incorporating these services into existing statutes that regulate car rental providers to reflect changes in how people secure transport in Alaska. It also extends the same laws and regulations that apply to rental car companies to private vehicle rental network companies, including the payment of the state's vehicle rental tax, which is currently a 10% tax for Alaska rental car providers. Ashley Carrick can walk through the sectional of the bill if you'd like, or if you have any questions. I guess in my overall statement, peer-to-peer car rental is similar to Airbnb, that someone uses their personal car, lists it on their platform. The common one that most people know is Turo, T-U-R-O, and then people can rent the car from the individual through the platform, much like Uber is a personally owned car that a driver the owner of the car will pick you up using a platform of Uber or Lyft. So they're very similar. And like Airbnb, you want to rent your house out or room in your house, you put it on the platform. People can use the platform to find you, and you pay some of your rental fee to the company that owns the platform, and some of it you keep yourself. So they're all very similar. And I will point out that Airbnb, which is heavily used in Alaska, does pay the bed tax in the municipalities that they operate. So they are liable for the taxes in that municipality. We don't have a state bed tax, but all Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, many municipalities have that tax, and Airbnb does pay that tax as well. So this bill basically is saying to Turo, if you know people are going to use your platform, people are going to rent their own personal car, those people renting the car should pay the state tax, similar to when you rent a Avis or a Hertz kind of car that you have to pay the state. And in Anchorage, they have a municipal tax as well, so you're paying more than one tax. So this bill just basically tries to get the peer-to-peer car rental companies in alignment with traditional rental companies.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. Would you like to?
Yeah, for the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Rep. Wohl. If I could just briefly walk through the sectional for us. So this bill amends Alaska Statute 43 and 45, and Section 1 says that this act is known as Vehicle Rental Modernization Act. Section 2 states that the existing vehicle rental tax for the state of Alaska should be provided by either the person leasing, renting a vehicle, or by a vehicle rental network, which is now defined as both a car rental company, similar to the traditional companies of Avis, Enterprise, Budget, et cetera, or to a vehicle rental network, for example, Turo, as my boss had mentioned. Section 3 references the definitions for vehicle rental business and vehicle rental network in Section 7. Section 4 states that a vehicle rental network is a business that arranges or executes personal passenger vehicle or recreational vehicle rentals and is subject to the same laws that govern vehicle rental businesses. Section 5 adjusts the language so that both a vehicle rental business or a person who owns and is leasing or renting their vehicle should disclose their costs, fees, airport costs, government taxes, and other surcharges as applied to customers. And Section 7 adjusts the language to specify that they can only charge fees relevant to recovering actual costs of operation. And this is just bringing rental vehicle networks in line with current statute related to vehicle rental companies. Finally, Section 7 deletes the definitions of car rental and rental car business and instead replaces those definitions with vehicle rental network to be more inclusive of these new business platforms. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for the presentation. If a individual were to rent their private vehicle on a peer-to-peer basis with the bed and breakfast business down the street and not go through a middleman, would they be beneath the horizon, so to speak, as far as any taxing or, I mean, if it's done on the quiet?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon. We had asked that question in Labor and Commerce Committee last year, and they would be liable to pay the state's tax. However, it would be quite difficult to collect that tax, as you can imagine. But it is important to include them in the language.
Yep. One last follow-up. Thank you. Is there an example out there? Maybe this is not answerable, but are there individuals that participate in this Turo program that own multiple cars, you know, half a dozen cars, for example, and really are running a business? Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Lebon, I'm glad you asked that question.
We don't know the actual number of Touro vehicles in Alaska. Touro won't release that information. There is a lawsuit that the state of Alaska is pursuing against Touro, and I think it's in litigation still, as it was last year when we presented this bill. That being said, I just anecdotally know an individual who recently quit her day job. She has an Airbnb rental, and she owns several vehicles solely for the purpose of Touro. And I don't mean one or two, but more on the line of five. So I know many people that are buying cars, nice cars, not intending to drive them around themselves, but to use them on the Touro platform. And if you go to Travelocity or any of the major sort of websites like that, and you type in rental car and put in a destination, of course all the traditional companies come up, but Touro comes up right alongside them, and you can look at their rates, and they're comparable and sometimes more expensive than the national brands. And their car rental places are sold out, especially in Alaska in the summer. And so the Touro rental people can get a pretty good dollar. And we had someone call in last year who rented a Jeep out of Anchorage. I think it was $100 a day or something. So it's not heavily discounted, that's for sure.
Are there any other questions? Oh, Representative Knopp.
Sounds like Uber Lyft legislation to me. Representative Wolf brings back memories. Actually, it's really what you're trying to do is pretty simplistic, and in a way it makes sense to me. But my question is, you've seen other states have done massive studies, Virginia being the one that comes to mind, and the user groups involved. And I mean, it's like a Bible. I mean, it's a half inch thick, and so I'm wondering why we don't have that need. Why are we not? So the argument's been made that, you know, there should be a bunch of user groups involved in looking at this, studying this, and I've seen the stack of papers and the studies and the people involved, and I'm sure you have. So just your thoughts on that.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, I know that different groups are opposing this, sort of technology groups and so on and so forth. And Touro is opposing it. And they've stated, look, we don't mind paying a tax. We just want to get together and have a negotiation and get with everyone. They basically want to pay a lower tax. So other states have adopted a slightly lower than their state tax rate. I'm not really sure the justification of that. I'm glad you mentioned Uber and Lyft. And I know we've had some good conversations about that. But for example, Uber, which is functional in Alaska and in Juneau in particular, and Juneau has a sales tax, unlike Anchorage or Fairbanks. So part of the Uber legislation stated that if there's a municipal tax, it is charged on the Uber platform. So that was part of the, if there's a tax, you pay it. Same with Airbnb. Airbnb pays a bed tax. I don't think it's discounted. They don't get a break because they don't have to hire housekeepers or bellmen or, you know, if anything, I would think the brick and mortar people have more expenses than the peer-to-peer people. So I don't really understand, other than the desire to offer a cheaper overall rate to their customers, I don't understand why the logic for a discounted tax rate. But yeah, they're going to make that argument.
Any other questions? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, I understand that we're talking about rental businesses and rental networks. I see here in the actual bill, line 11, it says a person who provides a leased vehicle or rented vehicle or the vehicle business. So I'm curious, is this going to apply to mom and dad who lease their vehicle to their child? They'll now be liable for a tax?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, this isn't intended for between family members, that's for sure. If you use the platform, like a Touro platform, that you lease your, you rent your, or lease your vehicle to a private individual that pays you through the platform, that's where this tax applies. I don't
basically, if you're in the car rental business, you should pay the car rental tax. And the state of Alaska took in over $10 million last year in vehicle rental tax. I'm sure that number would go up if the peer-to-peer people paid the tax, but since they won't tell us how many people have cars, it's hard to say. But when I found out a friend of mine quit her day job and is now in the Airbnb and car rental business, I thought to myself, maybe that's a pretty good line of work to look into. But it's certainly not intended for family members. As Representative LeBron pointed out, though, if you do a financial transaction between two people, you know, you're as liable as anyone else. And I'm not going to wade into that water too deeply, but I'm sure people make money in cash transactions that don't all report them. But, you know, if you cut someone's lawn and they give you $20, does that go in your income tax? You know, depends how thorough you are, I suppose. But this is for peer-to-peer platform rental. That's the intent of the bill.
And that follow-up, that's what I understood it to be. I'm specifically looking here at an unintended consequence of a non-business being interpreted as owing tax. That's specifically what I'm looking at.
If I might, through the chair to Representative Carpenter, the other potential catch in this legislation is to ensure that if Joe wants to start Joe's car rental business with six vehicles, not through the Churro platform, that audience might be captured. Whether there's people trying to operate independently, starting car rental businesses isn't something that we're currently aware of, but that was why this language was inserted into the bill, was more to capture people trying to run a car rental business as a primary source of income. And last year in House Labor and Commerce, as I mentioned to Representative LeBron, we did have Brandon Spanos from the Tax Division speak to the potential of enforcing a couple of individuals renting a car on their own contract. And the statement was, yes, that would technically be included in this bill. It would have to be reported in order for us to collect tax on that. And that would be fairly unlikely.
Nothing at this time. Thanks.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair, Representative Wool, my handy folder from 2019 shows my notes and they must have been made in this room, and I think. And they say that at that time, someone testified that they believed there were 700 cars being rented. So what kind of income are we forgoing that we could collect under your bill? Is there any way to know, or not income, but tax revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no, I think that's the $10 million question, because we don't really know. Toro won't give us the numbers of how many vehicles or how often they're rented. And we can hear anecdotal stories. But I don't know where they came up with the number 700. I don't know if that was, do you recall where that number came from?
Through the chair to Rep. Josephson, at some point during the discussions last year, a representative from Truro did get on the line and discuss their rough estimate of how many drivers they have, or how many owners they have renting vehicles in Alaska. And it was somewhere in the ballpark of 700, but that was, according to that representative, a very rough estimate. And we had heard several other estimates in that time frame as well.
Thank you.
So I have two questions. One, Representative Wool, your friend, when she's bought five or six cars, was she able to negotiate a deal with a manufacturer as far as those cars to get a discount? Like, I mean, most rental agencies, it's part of a manufacturing's marketing arrangement is to have car rentals with all X brand.
Co-Chair Johnson, I would have to say I don't know, and I haven't had that conversation. I'm guessing these cars weren't all acquired in a block purchase, but random purchases. But I honestly can't say.
And my second question is, one platform I think we're going to see more and more of, and it's just more in urban areas, but it could be something that happens even in Alaska and some of our urban areas, is that it's a platform similar to the rent-a-bikes, to the rent-a-scooter, that we're, you know, if you go visiting Lower 48, you'll see them all over town where you put in a coin and you get the scooter or you get the bike. And that same platform is something that is already out there for cars. How does that work into this?
Co-Chair Johnson, I'm familiar with that product. I've been, my niece lives in Portland and I go there, and occasionally if there's family in town, and those cars are just sitting on the street, you can just swipe your phone or take a picture of something and they unlock and you can rent them by the hour as well, not necessarily per day. That's a car rental platform just like Turo, and that's a vehicle rental that I would like to see fall under this umbrella as well, to pay a vehicle rental tax. I just don't see, you know, why we should forego potential revenue when traditional car rental companies are getting it from people too.
So are there any other questions? Thank you. With that, we'll set House Bill 102 aside. Our next meeting will be on Friday, February 28th at 9 a.m. when we will take up House Bill 205 and House Bill 206. Please note that next week we'll be scheduling 9 a.m. meetings every day to hear legislation, so plan accordingly. And it is currently 3:25, and this meeting is adjourned.